When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me as usual is Rich. Hello, Rich.
What's up, Jason?
Well, quite a exciting night for Last Dance episodes 3 and 4. Really, the show I think ramped up a lot in the last two episodes. The first two I certainly liked. You know, we talked about it. We enjoyed them. Learned a lot of new stuff, but I think the it felt like there was more reviewed, or at least there was more unbridled honesty than I expected in certain situations.
Yeah, and I think the other aspect that I really liked about this particular, you know, these two episodes that some people might kind of disagree with a little bit is there was a lot of sort of older footage and talk about old seasons. Like, honestly, if you added up the amount of, like, quote unquote, you know, 1998 content we got in these two episodes was pretty low, but I'm not complaining, man. Right. I like this stuff. I like going back to Doug Collins. I like adding to the triangle. I like, you know, Michael having to fight through the Pistons. Like, that stuff is, you know, obviously with the podcast we do, I'm all about that sort of stuff. So I could see that being a criticism that some people have that, oh man, this is focusing a little bit too much on all these things and not 1998, but I'm fine with that. It's a 10-part documentary. Like, there's not, you know, we're already in January 1998 and it's like, all right, Pippen's back. Okay. And that, like, there's nowhere else really to go until we start getting to the playoffs and getting to the finals and that sort of stuff. So I have no issue with it, but I can't see some people saying, like, wait a minute, isn't this about, like, the final season? Whereas, you know, I think you and I and anybody that really appreciates NBA history would be perfectly fine with these two episodes, because I think they were really, really good.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of highlights that we'll get to. But, you know, episode 3 focused mainly on Dennis Rodman coming to the Bulls in 96 and then where he is in the 98 season after two championships, sort of having a tough time keeping his motivation. Scottie Pippen leaving for a little while because of the injury, missing the first 35 games of the season, gives him some extra motivation. He likes sort of being the one guy that Jordan feels like he can rely on the team, you know, unequivocally, which is, I think, is interesting. And hopefully we'll get more into that as we focus on other guys on the team, like Kukoc in particular, who, as you've noted, has been absent so far for the documentary. Understandably that he's not, you know, he'll be part of the story later, I'm sure. But you know, a guy who definitely hasn't been part of it yet.
I'm about to get real mad if we go through the Olympics right. episode and we don't talk about Tony Kukoc. I know the next episode is about the Olympics. I'm like, okay, come on, you got to give me some Tony content. We got a little bit of Horace Grant content, so I'm okay.
Yeah,
there's okay. just one. Yeah, we're just missing Tony content, but then I'll be okay.
Right. Yeah. There. I mean, it wasn't like a whole lot of Horace Grant content.
It wasn't very flattering.
What we got was quality content. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know.
I did not know that Horace Grant still looked the way he did, man. That dude, I wouldn't walk down a dark alley.
Horace Grant, that dude
is still built. Like, he still looks like he'd get like 8 and 9. You know, if you put him out there in an NBA game, like,
right there, you go. Yeah, he'd be modern Reggie Evans.
You know? Exactly. Yeah, he looks like. Yeah. I'm not sure. Are we sure that Horace Grant and Reggie Evans are two different people? Have you ever seen them together? Think about it.
I haven't. No. Yeah. No. I mean, that would be. We'll have to see if there's some good investigation of that. You know, we'll have to dig into that one. But yeah, and the other focus of episode three is you know, related to Rodman is of course Jordan and the Bulls. Battles in the late 80s and into the early 90s with the Bad Boy Pistons that Rodman, of course, was an important part of. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we start with Rodman. You know, we get a little bit into the back history of, you know, his origin. You know, he, you know, basically was thrown out of his house when he was 18. He kind of spent a couple years in the streets, eventually ended up in college and, you know, in a small school in Oklahoma, is drafted in the second round by the Pistons and then takes a couple years to figure out, oh yeah, I can be really, really awesome at rebounding and defense and, you know, put this team into, you know, championship contention, which he does. And, you know, it is absolutely, fantastic. And then as the Pistons dynasty sort of breaks down, Rodman has a lot of personal struggles. We get into that, goes to the Spurs, which does not go particularly well, but personally starts to emerge as the guy with like colorful hair. He dates Madonna. He, starts to, you know, get, you know, pretty famous outside of basketball. And then of course, you know, ends up going to the Bulls.
Yeah. I do like that. Demolition Man was like the reason why he decided, yes, you know what, which right. is great. I love Demolition Man. I think it's a fun movie. So I will, sure. I'll defend Demolition Man to the end, but I just love the idea that he, you know, he gets out of the movie theater and goes, yeah, that's it. That's what I'm going to be. And that kind of gets everything going, which, you know, I respect that a little bit. And, one thing I want to know too, and I think I tweeted it out, tonight as well, that the trade to the Spurs is an interesting one because he is traded for Sean Elliott. So Sean Elliott started with the Spurs, which actually a lot of people probably forget because they know that he was a Spur for, you know, ever. You know, like I think everybody kind of remembers him as a Spur, and it's like, no, he had a brief run on the Pistons. I think he's even in NBA Jam as a Piston. And then the year after, he does 1 year with the Pistons and gets traded back to San Antonio. But it is not great deal by Detroit. So they trade Dennis Rodman for Sean Elliott. Then the next year trade Sean Elliott for Bill Curley. Good because a lot of people are listening going, who the hell is Bill Curley? Exactly. Not a good trade. So yeah, Detroit. And that was pretty typical of Detroit for the rest of the 90s and pretty much the early 2000s where they were not – other than drafting Grant Hill, there was not a lot of great moves going on in Detroit, unfortunately. So
no, not until, of course, the championship, you know, Joe Dumars goes in and they, you know, early 2000s, they start to get it up, absolutely. But yeah, you know, obviously, you know, Rodman is an incredible force. And you know, they bring up the fact that, you know, talk a lot about his personality, talk about how he, you know, is obviously a challenging guy, but also had an incredible energy, was, you know, did a lot of studying of how to, you know, figure out how to maximize his rebounding, understanding angles, understanding how to defend players. And of course, was basically the perfect basketball fit to the team because he didn't need the ball. He was incredible at defense and he could handle the rebounding load and let, you know, Jordan do Jordan things, Pippen do Pippen things. And, you know, everyone else kind of just fell in line. And, you know, they talk about how Jerry Krause was really reluctant to sign him. But his assistant, Jim Stack, basically talked him into it with the idea that, yeah, he'll respect Phil and MJ and Scottie. He's not going to have the same kind of problems that they have with the Spurs, who, you know, were a good team, but obviously didn't have the cachet that, you know, Jordan and Pippen did at that point with all the championships they'd had before.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing we should note as well, I think you and I have talked about it many times. Anytime we've really talked about Dennis Rodman or went through the career of Dennis Rodman or whatever, is that there was a time period too where he was a decent scorer. I mean, he averaged, you know, 11 points a game in his sophomore year. There was times where he actually was taking like one to two three-pointers a game, which, you know, at this time we're talking, you know, early 90s, that was, you know, pretty that's taking a lot of threes at that point. You know, he didn't make a ton of them, he wasn't a great shooter, but he was a scorer. He was kind of an all-around player. But then you start to see those final years in Detroit, San Antonio, and then obviously Chicago, where he just decided, you know what, I'll score off of putbacks. I'll score off of rebounds. But yeah, don't pass me the ball. I'm not really going to shoot. I'm not really going to do anything, but I'm going to get you 18 rebounds a game or 15 rebounds a game. Or I'm going to lead the league every single year in those. And yeah, it is kind of interesting that there was a time period. Like, he didn't come into the league with that mentality of I'm just going to get every single rebound and I don't care to score. Like, he did try to score. He was a scorer at some times. He wasn't a particularly great scorer. And I think obviously anybody would agree that his best asset was, you know, the rebounding and stuff. But this is a guy who did lead the league in field goal percentage for a year. You know, in 1989, he led the league, you know, 59.5% because he was, you know, he was taking shots and he was making shots. But yeah, quickly he realized, hey, my best asset, and particularly when he went to the Bulls, was like, look, don't even think about passing to me. There's no need to do it. I'll just get rebounds and I'll score off that. But I do think for people that haven't done the research or haven't looked at it, you should be aware that Dennis Rodman did change his game, that he wasn't always just that player. I think it sort of adapt and evolve into that.
Yeah, and obviously, being that player, he was incredible at it. He was one of those guys who could be a superstar as a role player. Yeah. You know, like we talked with Kelly Dwyer last time, we talked on the show we did with him recently, where he was one of those guys who was just so good at those little things, even though, you know, he didn't do much scoring, especially later on in his career. He just was able to contribute by doing everything else. And obviously he filled that role with the Pistons as well, and was really, you know, key. You know, the Adrian Dantley trade that, you know, Isaiah Thomas has maligned for was a very helpful basketball trade in a sense, because, you know, it gave Rodman an opening to start and to have a bigger role on that team.
Yeah.
To take minutes to Dantley, you know, who could score, but, you know, is a bad defensive player. It was kind of the final piece to make them, you know, really a championship contender, and was absolutely, you know, I mean, he wasn't the top guy on that team, but he was absolutely essential to the fact that they won championships. And I think essential, you know, I don't think the Bulls win three championships in a row without Rodman. I mean, maybe they win one or two, but I don't think they win all three for sure.
No. And yeah, he brought an extra, because it everything that he did allowed Pippen to do, you know, what he needed to do, to allow Jordan to do what he needed to do, to allow Tony Kukoc to do what he needed to do, to allow basically everybody else to do that. And yeah, if your primary big man is, you know, a Luke Longley type or whatever, forget who knows who they could have had a power forward or whatever, but if it was like Luke Longley was your big man, like, that's, I don't know if there's quite enough there. And like you said, they were similar to those Pistons teams, as well as a lot of the 98, 97, 96 Bulls. They were a very, very good team, but a lot of it was off, like, the attitude that they presented to you. You know, like, they were still tremendously, you know, gifted players, still really, really good, but Jordan was starting to slow down even a slight amount. Pippen was starting to slow down a slight amount. His injuries were mounting up. You know, they needed to kind of be that team that did everything the right way and worked on the edges and did that sort of stuff. And that's the kind of play, you know, player Rodman is. He's the guy that will get, like, a game-breaking, you know, offensive rebound, or, you know, just completely, you know, hound your opposing player and get him, you know, his focus out of the game or whatever. And that's really the stuff that the Bulls and similar to the Pistons as well, where they really relied on that and really used, you know, Rodman's skills in those fringes to really, really help them out. So yeah, I'm right with you. I think he's a huge asset to those last three titles.
Yeah. And, you know, the other part of the documentary, the main focus was, you know, Jordan, basically the rise of Jordan, starting the rivalry with the Pistons. So the Bulls hire Doug Collins before the 87 season. Jordan loves Collins, loves playing for him, you know, really motivated to play for him. It's a very Jordan-centric offense. I mean, you know, Jordan, you know, would he average like 36, 37 points per game 1 year? I mean, it's something obviously really crazy. It's something that was, you know, outside of Wilt, you know, no one had ever done. And, you know, there's a fun story that Collins tells about, you know, his coaching debut. It's in Madison Square Garden. You know, it's close. You know, Collins is really nervous, and Jordan basically is like, yeah, chill out. I'm not going to let you use the first game. And then he ends up scoring 50 points in Madison Square Garden and, you know, and so forth. And they talk about, you know, they had a few ups and downs here and there. There's one famous time where Doug's in front of the cameras, and then he calls Michael over. He says, "Yeah, come give me a kiss so we can kiss and make up." And, you know, he does. And it's a funny moment. But then we get to, of course, you know, the Bulls, the fact that the Bulls and the Cavs are kind of rising in the East in 89. And of course, you know, the famous series, Jordan hitting the shot, you know, with it, what's easy to forget is that the Cavs, you know, were 6-0 against the Bulls in the regular season there, and we're actually kind of the favorite team. But you know, that was definitely a key moment, obviously, in the Jordan narrative. Obviously, the shot's extremely famous. We talked about it on the show, and you know, just it kind of the idea that it got them over the hump finally of like, okay, we've won a playoff series, we're starting to be winners, we've changed around this team, you know. Grant and Pippen are about to come along. You know, you're starting to see the team that would emerge in the next couple of years right at this point.
Right. And one thing that's pretty interesting about this time period and this building of the Bulls team and the slow maturity and the, okay, now we've gotten over this hump. Okay, now we have this new hump with the Pistons. And then, okay, we got through that. And I think I saw a few tweets coming out about it while it was happening too, is that like, imagine like in today's NBA, like this team is not together for all these years. You know what I mean? Like they lose against the Pistons the second year and it's like, all right, forget it. Pippen, you're out of here. Jordan's right. Leaving. Like this sort of stuff, like, you know, cherish when you see these stories, because like, I don't know that stuff like this is ever going to happen again. Like, I don't know that teams are ever going to slowly but surely kind of, okay, well this year it didn't work, but here's what we're going to do. Okay. We got over that hump, and now we got this hump. That's fine. Like, we're going to get over that and get over that. Maybe one of these days we'll see it again, but it feels like such a far, like, that's something that just seems so foreign in today's NBA, where it's like, you know, try it out, see what happens for a year or two, and if it doesn't work, all right, blow it all up and do it all over again. It's kind of nuts. But, yeah, it's cool to see a team that, like, this was what it was. Okay, we finally beat the Cavs. We finally won a playoff series. Let's go. And then boom, and now here's the Pistons. And it's like, ah, shit. Like, we're not here yet. Like, we still have another hump. And it was the huge, tremendous, like, sigh of relief to finally get a playoff win. But it was still years and years and years away from them actually getting over what was the true hump, which is the Detroit Pistons, which is a really cool story to tell. And it makes the first Jordan title and the first Bulls title all that much more important and poignant, knowing that they battled and clawed and scratched or whatever for 4 or 5 years to get to that point is really cool. And really, yeah, like I said, kind of foreign in today's NBA, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. And then sort of the end, you know, we get a little bit into the Pistons. Basically, you know, they felt that the NBA wanted Jordan to win. They felt that they were in the way. You'd be surprised that the Pistons have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder. It's hard to believe. It's bad work, you know.
Not that team.
they talk about the Jordan rules, you know, that of course they famously had. Obviously they got very physical with him. The idea of stopping him before he takes flight, hit him in the paint. You know, there's a lot of clips of them knocking him around, a lot of physical basketball between the two. And, you know, obviously the Pistons were known for that. It was very effective. They won a couple championships, but of course I think they also are excessively maligned in history because of that as well. So I guess they got what they wanted, but it also hurt them in a sense in the end as well.
Yeah, and we've touched on this in the past as well on the show. But yeah, for people that haven't listened, like, you know, what we've always said about the Pistons is like, to get over the hump and to become a successful team, they had to sort of shed. Or not necessarily shed, but create this image of toughness and we're a badass team. We shove you to the ground, and maybe not create that image, like, but actually be that type of team. And they weren't that team. Like, they were a pretty good team. They were a successful team, but to really get over the hump and for them to feel like they had finally made it, they kind of had to slow things down and become that kind of bruising team or whatever. The Bad Boys documentary does a great job of touching on that well, where it's like, yeah, here's this team that can really kind of get up and down the court and has a bunch of good scores and a bunch of, you know, good players. And hey, Laimbeer's got a lot of skills and talent and all that sort of stuff. But like, you never hear about that. You hear about, well, here's Bill Laimbeer shoving somebody to the floor. Here's Rick Mahorn, you know, elbowing somebody in the face. And here's Isaiah Thomas just being, you know, Isaiah Thomas, just a pain in the ass or whatever. And that's kind of their own doing. Like, you feel bad because you're like, oh man, the Pistons, like, no, there's so much more to them. But then you're like, ah, man, but they kind of wanted it this way. Like, this is really
right.
The way that they wanted to, and their success was largely, you know, based off this. It wasn't just like a coincidence that they became this type of team and all of a sudden the success came. Like, they punched the Boston Celtics literally and figuratively to get over up and to win those titles. So it's a fair assessment to be like, yeah, that's what these guys were. I do see a lot of people push back on that and go, no, it's like, no, there's so much more than that. And it's like, they are, but like, they wanted this. They own this. I mean, they were selling Bad Boys shirts. You know what I mean? Like, they're not like, hold on a minute. What? Right. Like, hey, we're not bad. Like, they were literally selling Bad Boys shirts. They had Bad Boys flags. Like, they knew it. They knew what they were. So, No, we don't need any revisionist history. They knew what the hell they were, and they were fine being that, too. So,
sure. A couple of the things. I like the story about Phil's first meeting with Rodman and Rodman's quote, "I don't care, whatever, what's up," after Phil asked him if he wanted to join the team. So
I think we could all take that attitude into life. Right? I enjoy that attitude.
I feel like if I ever talked to Phil Jackson, I would have that attitude as well.
You know? Right. Phil's like, here you go. Here's a book about, you know, coyotes migrating. And you're like, yeah, right. I don't care, man.
Yeah, whatever. That's cool. Yeah. And, you know, Jordan and Rodman both getting sick of, you know, the media hassle. Jordan having to have questions about the final year. Of course, we talked about with Pippen making the trade demand previously and getting questions about that. And Rodman's quote of, "I play the games for free, you get paid for the bullshit," is is a great one as well. And then, you know, Pippen comes back after 35 games off. And then the story of Rodman feeling like he's getting a little bit lost because he's not needed, doing more drinking and partying. And then I love the best part of the documentary so far, up until something we're going to talk about in episode 4, is you get it from Jordan and from Rodman and from Pippen and from Phil's point of view of Dennis basically saying, "Hey, I need a vacation." They finally agree to 48 hours in Vegas, and this is going to tie into episode 4. So maybe we'll cut it off there and go in episode 4. Unless you have anything else you want to talk about.
I don't. I'm excited to talk about the vacation here in a bit, but yeah, I think that's it for episode 3 that I have.
Okay. So continuing with episode 4, we get a Carmen Electra appearance, which I was not expecting, but
looking fantastic too. Good for her.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And she admits that she hid from Michael Jordan in the hotel room when Jordan came, and, you know, after 48 hours had passed and Rodman hadn't showed up, he went there and is like, "Hey, buddy, let's get going." Jordan's quote was, "I ain't going to say what was in the bed or where he was." So, but yeah, I mean, just the whole story of just everyone's reaction to seeing Jordan tell the story. And, you know, Rodman laughing and Pippen laughing and, you know, Phil, and that was priceless. That was pretty good.
Yeah. I also like the idea too, that they needed somebody to go to Las Vegas to pick up Dennis Rodman, and,
right.
Believe it or not, it wasn't Scott Burrell or it wasn't, you know, Bill Weddington. Yeah. It was Michael Jordan's like, "Hey, you know what? I'll do it. I'll spend a day over in Las Vegas." Like, I just love it. He's the first one to be like, "Yeah, hey, I'm going to do it."
Yeah. Well, I don't think Jordan was any stranger to Vegas.
That's either, what I said. Yeah. He was like, "You know what? I'll do it. Yeah.
Why not?"
I'm sure he gave Rodman another 6 or 7 hours while he went and did his thing. I was like, all right, let's do this. Let's pick him up. Like,
yeah. I mean, I'm assuming that they're going to bring up the idea of, like, yeah, Jordan was no stranger to the nightlife either, you know. I mean,
yeah, so far sure we have Michael Jordan who's like walking in a hotel room, like, "Oh my god, alcohol, marijuana, oh my god, naked Carmen Electra, gross,
what?
Ew."
Yeah, right.
Like, you're Michael Jordan, which,
right,
the Carmen Electra thing was hilarious too, because she had been like playable like numerous times before that, and it's like, I don't think like Michael Jordan's gonna be too upset, like, or too like, like, "Oh my god, a naked woman, oh my god, it's Carmen Electra." Like, just the whole thing is just incredible. What a moment that in time that was. Is Michael Jordan opening the room in a nude Carmen Electra and a whatever the hell Dennis Rodman, you know, in a hotel room, and him just being like, "Oh dear God, what the hell's going on? The hell, I just want to play basketball." But yeah, oh man, incredible. Yeah, I love Dennis Rodman's stories are just the best.
Yes.
It's hard to believe he's a real human being.
Episode 4. Focus a lot on Phil Jackson, talk about, you know, kind of his background and growing up in Montana, his evangelical background of his parents. And then of course, you know, getting into, a lot of, Native American culture and, Buddhism as well. And, you know, kind of, you know, getting more into like his philosophies as a person, as building a team. Also, I never really thought about it, and I don't entirely know if the comparison works, but the parallels between Phil and Rodman as players in terms of their style of play and, you know, and kind of doing the dirty work and sort of being misfits of their teams. I mean, I can see it. I mean, obviously Rodman was a way better player than Phil was, but, you know, maybe a little bit of a stretch, but, you know, it's something I never really thought about before.
Yeah, no, I know a Phil style, but yeah, I had never really made that parallel either, that like maybe one of the best people to unlock, you know, what Dennis Rodman and the real, you know, everything that Dennis Rodman could be, you know, Phil Jackson might be a good guy to do that. Cause yeah, he's like, hey, look, I get it. I understand doing the dirty work and right. being that sort of player too. So yeah, that was pretty cool. And, I always love seeing clips of like Phil Jackson in the '70s, man. Like he was it. I love the beard, the hair.
Oh, yeah.
Like he rocked that. Like I've never, I don't really ever particularly think the Knicks jerseys, like I'm a weirdo like that. I don't like the Knicks and I don't really care about the Knicks jersey or the Knicks history or whatever, man. He made it work. Yeah. He had that blue and that just, I don't know. Yeah. It's just like it was fun to see clips of old Phil Jackson, you know, playing as well, because I think a lot of people know he plays in the NBA, but yeah, like you said, to forget maybe how he played or the style he played or what he looked like when he played too, or that he was doing acid while he's playing as well, which is also a pretty fun story that we found out too. So
that's good. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, coaching in Puerto Rico stories, you get some video of that. And then with the Albany Patroons and the CBA,
I want a CBA documentary so badly. Oh, yeah. I know there's no footage. And like it's impossible to cobble together stories because it's such a ridiculous league. Yeah. Like, there's not even like a good book about the CBA either. I've tried, I've looked, I've searched. There's nobody really has collected the CBA in one. I'm not offering to do it because God only knows how you even start doing that. But man, the CBA's got so many good stories and so many weird people that have run through it and so many random teams or whatnot that I couldn't wait. But yeah, the Puerto Rico thing was pretty wild too, with, you know, freaking guys getting shot, the mayor shooting
somebody.
Like we don't have enough of that in today's NBA. You know what I mean? I want the mayor of, I want Kevin Johnson, the mayor of Sacramento. He's not still the mayor anymore. He can't be, right?
I was going to say,
after everything that went on, hopefully he's not anymore.
I would assume he's not.
That's the only, I can't think of any other like famous mayors other than Chicago, but that's boring.
I guess you can be president, so I guess it doesn't really matter actually. But anyway, so moving on, back in 89-90, you know, we get into Jerry Krause's love of Tex Winter and the triangle. And of course the philosophical collision with Doug Collins, who is most of his plays focus on isolating MJ. And you know, I think Jerry intended for Doug to learn from Tex Winter because he loves Tex Winter, but you know, Doug and Tex end up fighting. Tex end up getting demoted from the bench. Phil, I think, sees the writing on the wall and understands, like, you know, hey, my GM loves this guy, so I'm gonna pick Tex's brain. Doug refers vaguely to the sense that Phil could become the coach, and is asked to expound further, but does not really, you know, with the idea, and, you know, and of course they make the change, and Jordan chafes at the change. Like, he likes the idea, like, Doug put the ball in my hands, but eventually comes to see the wisdom of, you know, kind of getting the other team more involved. Even though he says, I didn't want Bill Cartwright to have the ball in his hands with 5 seconds left, which is a funny quote. But, you know, he obviously, you know, Scotty emerges as a point forward, as an all-star for the first time in 1990. Horace Grant as well moves forward. So, you know, obviously he sees that it starts to pay dividends, you know, pretty early on.
Yeah, the you know, switching coaches, you know, after an Eastern Conference Finals berth, some big balls, man. That's tough to do. That would get you eaten alive. And even at the time, a lot of questions as well. They kind of glossed over it and kind of said, yeah, the transition, yeah, then Phil Jackson was the coach, and yada, yada, let's go. But, like, I, you know, go back and read some stuff from the time. Like, it was pretty, like, what are you doing? And especially when, like, you know, the quotes from Michael weren't exactly like, yeah, this is something I want. Like, it was yet another, you know, it could have been seen, had it not worked out the way it did, another one of the, well, Jerry Krause is fucking with this team, what is he doing, type things. But then it ends up being, oh, well, to Phil Jackson, actually, never mind. It's great because Phil's perfect and Tex is able to, you know, do a little bit of, you know, add the triangle and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, at the time, it's like, and Phil even, I think he had a quote about it as well, where he's like, yeah, look how, like, I was going to tell the best player and an icon in sports, a multiple-time MVP, hey, stop, you know, doing what you do and give the ball to your teammates more. And it's like, that's hard to sell, especially to, you know, someone as strong-willed as Michael Jordan. It took a lot of just making Phil the coach and then Phil coming in there and instilling that triangle right off the bat, too, is you know, it obviously worked tremendously. The success is there. But, yeah, that's like, that's very difficult to do. Like, I could see absolutely most teams or most leagues or most people being perfectly fine. Hey, look, we lost the Eastern Conference Finals. Let's run it back. Let's figure out what's going to go on. And, you know, we're not changing anything. For them to change everything and as drastically as they did is pretty wild.
Right. And there's a lot of push pull, you know, from Jordan. I mean, he embraced it sometimes, he didn't at other times. Yeah. Obviously there's flexibility with Phil in there. And you know, Kobe and Phil went through a lot of the same stuff as well. And but yeah, it obviously, you know, obviously it worked out pretty well at the end. So, you know, we the rest of the series, you know, there's a little bit in 98, which we'll get into in the end, but the rest of it basically focuses on, you know, okay, more battles with the Pistons. You know, they lose in 88. They get closer in 89, but they lose again in 89. And then 90, Phil's first year, they lose in seven games. And Jordan's smile at that's the Scotty migraine game is very notable. I would say his sort of, I don't know how I would describe that smile exactly. Like a knowing smile. Like I get the impression that Jordan is not entirely convinced about Scotty Pippen's migraine.
Oh no, for sure. Yeah. Even to, yeah. I mean, God, it's, it's in 1990 right. And we're in 2020
or if he cares about it or if he believes that he doesn't care, he thinks he should, you know, he doesn't believe in migraines or he doesn't believe migraines should hold you
yeah,
back.
Yeah. I think the smile there was definitely a, yeah, Scotty just didn't have it that game. He wasn't mentally tough. And yeah, it's the quote unquote migraine game. Okay. Yeah, sure. Whatever. Like that, right. That's the way that I read it. And everything that I've known about the situation too, is that Michael's always kind of thought, yeah, that I don't really quite believe
right.
that, which
I find that, yeah.
I mean, I don't know who the hell knows, but like, right. You know, Michael Jordan showed up to the quote unquote flu game. And it's not like Scotty, I mean, Scotty did play 42 minutes in the game. It's not like, you know,
right.
It wasn't like, ah, you know what? I can't even get out there. And he played 4 minutes and then went to the locker room. Like he still played a lot of minutes, but he just, yeah, he wasn't very good in the game. So,
right. Sure. So, you know, after that, you know, they make a big deal about, you know, MJ starts weight training,
which,
you know,
can I bring up something real quick?
Sure.
Okay. Like I love old basketball. Old basketball is great. The idea that like Michael Jordan after like, you know, like it's 7 years in the league is like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start lifting some weights. Like think about that compared to like today's NBA and the way that today's NBA and the nutrition and the weightlifting and that sort of, just the idea that it's like Michael being like, ah, you know what I'm going to do this year? I'm going to lift weights. He's already like a two-time MVP. Like, you know, he's almost 30 at this point. And like, yeah, it's just what a very, very different NBA it is now than you know, it was back then. But
sure. And, you know, Jordan admits that, you know, the idea that he wasn't thought of as a winner in the same way that Magic and Bird were really ate at him, you know, Grant and Pippen admit sort of a combination of being motivated by Jordan, also fearing him. So that obviously motivated them to work harder and to also lift and become better players. So, you know, and then Jordan also said, yeah, I started to feel like I could count on them, you know, first Pippen and then Grant right afterward. And then we get into the 1990 playoff series against the Pistons. And I would say this whole sequence is so far the highlight of the documentary, supplementing the highlight from the last show. Would you agree?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. I love this. And yeah, put the cherry on top is Horace Grant's quote at the end. But yeah, good, great stuff at this.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, the idea, you know, and it, of course, if for those who don't know, the Bulls ended up sweeping the Pistons in that series. The Pistons notoriously walk out before the game is, you know, like with eight, like 5 seconds left or whatever. The game's, of course, you know, is in hand, but not officially done. And they walk out without shaking, you know, the Bulls' hands on the floor. Horace Grant's quote on that is straight up bitches is the way that they left the game. Jordan refers to the 91 series as putting them out of their misery. Obviously it exercises a lot of demons. The Bulls are physical. They hit back. And, you know, Isaiah Thomas attempts to explain the Pistons' position. They've done this before, you know, the Bad Boys obviously had a documentary as well. And I said, he does raise a good point about, you know, the fact that the 88 Celtics treated them very much in the same way of walking off the floor, you know, as the game was going on. Dant was shooting a free throw. And then Isaiah actually has to run over to Kevin McHale and like basically sarcastically extends his hand out. And then McHale, you know, reluctantly shakes it. You know, so Isaiah does make a good point there. But Jordan makes a better one about how, like, yeah, in 89, 90, you know, we shook their hands when they were losing. You know, we deserved that from them. You know, they were bullshit. And, you know, and obviously Isaiah is an asshole. And a bigger one than Jordan, you know, so.
Yeah,
so,
that was like 5 minutes where you're just like, man, who's the bigger asshole? And you're like, well, they both right. are.
it's clearly Isaiah, but yeah
for sure. No, it's definitely Isaiah Thomas is absolutely the worst.
Right.
Yeah, so
right.
That entire time, I'm old, even though he's like mildly right, I'm still rolling my eyes because it's still Isaiah. Like Isaiah could tell you, like Isaiah could give you the best advice in the world, and you're just like, ah, shut the fuck up, dude. Like, you know, go away. Like, he's just, you know, even if he was justified, even if he was right, which, you know, dubious at best, it's Isaiah Thomas, so it's just like, ah, oh, fuck off, dude. Go away.
I think the Pistons do have a point in some respects about how they were treated about the NBA and how they were seen.
Sure.
But, you know, it's kind of like, well, you're right, but you're also an asshole. That's kind of the way I feel about the Pistons in general. So, Jerry Krause dancing.
Fantastic. I loved it.
It was
not bad. Yeah. Not bad. Like, no, I'm not a good dancer. I'm about equal as Jerry Krause. I appreciate it. It was nice. Yeah.
I someday want to see you dance.
You won't, because I have a chance like Jerry Krause.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I guess I have to win an NBA championship or get real hammer, right. Which appeared to be what was going on in that bus.
So. I believe that. Yeah, that was after they beat the Pistons.
Yeah, he was holding the cup in his hand, and I'm sure there was coke in there.
yes, to the Cool Modi montage. We didn't talk about it, but there's some very good montages in this episode as well.
Fantastic. That's going to be the legacy of this series is going to be these montages. I mean, they are the perfectly curated music, great highlights. Whoever worked on that, I don't know if it was the same people that will be the legacy, I think, of this more than anything. And I hope all those are just clipped out and put on websites so we can all watch them for the rest of time, because they're perfect. Yeah, you get Prince just booming through your speakers while Jordan's just dunking on people and becoming a legend. It's just
Party Man. Great. Oh, that was perfect. That was absolutely perfect. The Beastie Boys one with Rodman's rebounding was really good too. But
Party
Man was definitely the best one. And not quite as much of a montage, but it was the Kool Moe Dee song they're rocking to as Jerry Krause is dancing is in going through that footage. That's some good stuff too. And then, we sort of end with this portion of it with the 91 finals, of course, you know, Magic versus Michael. You could not have had a more perfect finals matchup from a marketing standpoint of, you know, the old guard versus the new guard, the way that basically, you know, you transition from the old champion to the new champion, the old dynasty to the new dynasty, you know, it pretty much you couldn't have done it in a better way.
Yeah, I love that. It's a great series too, if you ever get a chance to watch it, or see games from it, because it feels like it feels like a very interesting moment in like NBA history where you could tell that like there's something big coming, and like the NBA is never gonna be the same again. Because like the Lakers, who in the 80s were this like showtime and they're bouncing all over the court and doing all this sort of stuff and having the time of their lives or whatever, they are just like abused in those final few games. Once they put Pippen on Magic, it's like Magic looks like the oldest guy you've ever seen in your life. Like, this guy was ever good? Like, this guy was ever an NBA player? Like, he still had good games, but it was like, oh my god, he so physically was getting overwhelmed. And the Bulls, I mean, their defense at the time was incredible too. Horace Grant, who again is not really getting enough love in this, is all over the court, bouncing all over the place, blocking everybody. Jordan's everywhere, Pippen's everywhere, and you're like, oh my god, like, geez, this team is completely like they're gonna rule the NBA forever. Like, this is what basketball is gonna be. And for a while, yeah, it obviously was that way. But it's a very illuminating series where you just see, like, okay, it's very obvious who the old guard is and who the new guard is. And the Bulls just go in there and they blitz the Lakers, and the Lakers didn't even see what was coming. And the torch is passed. And you can even the interview, I like that footage where they interviewed Magic after the game too. And he's just like, well, he's with the perfect Magic smile. He's just like, well, if someone had to beat us, it's those guys. And you can tell Magic's just like, well, that's it for me. I'm out, guys. Like,
right.
It's been a fun decade, but I'm out.
Yeah. So right. Yeah. Anyway, and then, you know, you see, you know, Michael crying in Magic arms when they meet, you know, and they talk. Yeah, and obviously you see Jordan's emotional reaction, and obviously winning that championship got a lot of, you know, demons out of, you know, from him. Actually, there's a lot of demons that he had, you know, the idea that like he wasn't a winning player, or that, you know, he could score, but, you know, couldn't win championships. It's still weird in retrospect that was a very conventional wisdom thing for a few years, but it definitely was. That definitely people believe that. I remember that very, very strongly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, sure. Yeah. And then, you know, again, not much in 1998. You know, really we get, some evidence of Michael Jordan kind of being a dick. Day after the Super Bowl,
what?
They're on the team plane, or getting on the team plane. And then Jordan is loudly berating people for who picked the Packers, you know, cause the Broncos won and he won a bet, and he shows like a huge amount of money.
To be fair, when you say a huge amount of money, for you and I, yes, winning $100 in a bet is a huge amount. That man made $35 million that year.
Okay, $100. Okay, well, I get not that huge amount of money. I couldn't tell what kind of bill it was.
Yeah, I think it was just $100 bill, and he was so happy to have won $100 bill from like Scott Burrell, who's probably, you know, Scott Burrell's making $50K that year. Like $100 does mean a lot to Scott Burrell. And there's, you know, Jordan, who made $35 million, be like, yeah, I beat you, you bitch. Here's my $100. And it's like, oh, dear.
Right. and then Burrell, like Jordan, you know, Jordan and Burrell sitting across from each other. And then Jordan, and at first I thought he was talking about Rodman.
I think Burrell thought he was too, because you could see Burrell kind of look around and be like, yeah, he's talking about Rodman. Oh, no.
About me. And he's like, oh, this guy never goes to sleep. You know, this guy's up all night. You know, I don't know what he's doing. And he's like, oh, man, don't say this in front of the cameras. You know, he's being nice about it at first, but Jordan is just like egging him on. He's like, oh, man, don't put this on tape, man. My parents are going to see this. So
I also believe at that time that Scott Burrell probably had a girlfriend, because he's just like, yeah, no, because like I think Jordan even says like, if he settled down with one, like, he ain't settled down with one, he's out every night. He's just like,
oh yeah,
god damn.
Yes. So yeah, we get some evidence of Michael Jordan, you know, being Michael Jordan, and we end with a Jerry Krause doing an interview with the newspaper, where he makes it clear again that Phil won't be back. And basically, you know, the things have been going better for the Bulls. They've been playing a lot better. You know, they're first in the East, you know, Pippen's back, you know, Rodman's pretty much in line. So it's odd timing for Krause to, you know, bring up the idea again, you know, with another round of questions of, you know, asking Jordan what he feels about the comments that Phil won't be back, and making Jordan ask all the questions and answer all the questions he doesn't want to answer about coming back, and so on and so forth. So I think the tactical thing was just that, or I think people generally said that Krause, you know, obviously Krause isn't here to say what he thought, and no Reinsdorf in this episode, interestingly enough, but it doesn't seem like Krause just made a strategic mistake there. He wasn't really thinking when he said it, or what have you, or maybe just wanted to put a stamp on the team and, you know, just to have his ego assuaged. But
yeah, it was definitely like the timing was terrible and everything was pretty bad. And yeah, the implication again that, you know, he's essentially saying that him and Phil are done. And again, it's just like posturing between all the parties here is, you know, him saying him and Phil are done. That's what he's going to have at the end of the season. Jordan saying, well, I'm not going to play for another coach, but Phil. And then Krause basically, I think he's just trying to get out ahead of the story in a way and try to maybe make him, you know, the sympathetic figure, you know, Jerry Krause saying, hey, look, like, we'd love to have Jordan back, but he doesn't want to play for anybody but Phil. But it's like, man, but you are going to get rid of Phil. Like, just, you know, don't get rid of Phil then, if that's going to be the case. But obviously, the way things were, it felt like it was a completely untenable situation at this point. But yeah, it's a very weird, weird period. And again, as we've said, and as you kind of alluded to there, no Jerry Reinsdorf here. So it's not like the idea wasn't unilaterally Jerry Krause saying, you know what, let's get rid of this Phil Jackson guy. Jerry Reinsdorf had a part in that too, but it's a lot easier to go, hey, the dead guy, he said it.
It was him.
He did it all alone. It was that guy, the dead guy that you can't ask for follow-up. But that's going to be a part of this whole thing. So it's like, whatever at this point.
Right. You know. Yeah. you got to deal with it. So yeah, but yeah, two really great episodes overall. Fun stuff. I'm excited to keep watching, keep talking about it, and rewatch some of the old montages.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're 4 for 4, man. These have been really, really good and just easy watches, man. The 2 hours blow by. I don't know about
right,
you,
but absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
I look down at the clock. I'm like, man, it's already 9:45. Like, shit, right. We're gonna do this podcast in about 15 minutes, man. They blow by, and I think like the commercials. There's so few commercials too, which it just gets you kind of. I'm kind of surprised. Like, I thought this thing would be like wall-to-wall commercials, given like how many people are watching these and the ratings that came out last week or whatnot. I thought we were just going to get inundated by commercials, but I like the idea that whatever they did, they probably just had, you know, 4 or 5 really high paid, you know, commercial spots throughout the show and just said, all right, Facebook and, you know, I'm blanking on a few of the other companies that are sponsoring it, but yeah, like you guys pay up a shit ton of money and we're going to keep it as low as commercial. Like there's not, you know, the commercial doesn't go and it's like 3 minutes of straight of just like, you know, 30 second commercials. It's like one or two big commercials, a sponsored spot, and then we get right back to it, which is pretty cool. It makes it go by, I think, a little bit easier too.
Absolutely. So anything else to talk about?
I got nothing else, man. I'm gonna just go listen to Party Man for the rest of the night until I fall asleep. So yeah. Oh, can we talk about the very weird Jordan Sniff Brothers thing?
Oh,
what the hell was that?
Well, they were his posse, I guess. They were like his security team and his like hangers on. Yeah,
so the one guy had like a mullet, even though it was 1998. He had a mullet and a mustache.
Right.
They were called the Sniff Brothers for some weird reason, and then they definitely said that Michael Jordan could cover up sexual abuse if he had the Sniff Brothers, right? Because they're talking about the president, and he's like. I misunderstood that. What was going on? I think you misunderstood a little bit.
So Jordan, they're called the Sniff Brothers because they sniff Jordan's jock. And I think I think they are mostly like work at the arena or like So and they're referencing like the affair that Clinton had. So not literal sexual abuse. I mean more just like the nefarious, but not quite. But
right. Okay,
that's fair.
Well, he's an estranged uncle at this point. But my estranged uncle, he actually worked security for the United Center around that time. But he was unfortunately not one of the Sniff Brothers. I got a little excited every time I see the backstage stuff. I'm kind of looking for him every so often. He does show up in a few episodes of Nitro, WCW Nitro, though. In one scene, is seen getting yelled at, berated by Eric Bischoff, which I always found really fun at the time. And I was like, I don't think he quite knew what was going on. Like, I don't know if he quite knew all about wrestling or whatnot, but. That was that. But I don't. We don't talk to him anymore. We don't know what happened to him. So that's fine. I would like to follow up with him right now, but I don't. Don't think that would go over too well.
All right. Well. Anyway. Thanks everyone for checking us out. You can find us at the Step Back at fansided/NBA, and we are also, of course, on Facebook and Twitter at Over and Back NBA, and you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, pretty much wherever you listen to a podcast. We're going to be working on getting some of the archive up, hopefully. We'll definitely, if nothing else, we'll definitely focus on getting some of the Jordan and Bulls related stuff back up. We're sort of in a transition on that, but you might be seeing a few of the older episodes that haven't been available for several months back online. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to those, they'll be available for you to supplement this content.
Absolutely. Yeah. A little out of our hands with that situation, but we're doing whatever we can to fix it and get it right. So it looks like things are on the right path there. So hopefully, the archive will be back pretty soon. The archive is available all on YouTube as well, though. So if you are looking for any of our past episodes, everyone with the exception of like one or two, I think I've figured out, are on there. But every like major great episode I think we have up there is up there on YouTube as well. So if you want to get our archives for right now, YouTube is the best spot. But we are planning on getting everything else up there again. Finally, we had some people be like, "Hey, I'm looking for this episode, and I looked at my podcast and I can't find it." And it's like, we know it's out of our hands, unfortunately, but we seem to have fixed it. So.
All right, cool. All right, well, thanks everyone for checking us out. We're back again soon.
town.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.